This is NPR's Morning Edition. I'm Bob Edwards. The Supreme Court today revisits one of its most controversial decisions, Miranda versus Arizona. The 1966 decision required police to inform suspects of their right to remain silent and to have an attorney present during an interrogation. NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg reports.
Though Miranda set off a storm of controversy when it was decided 34 years ago, today it's so widely accepted that it's part of the nightly TV cop show fare.
Mr. Coburn, you're under arrest for the murder of Marcus Tate. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you do say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to an attorney. If you cannot afford one, one will be provided for you. Do you understand these rights?
So you may wonder, why is the Supreme Court going to take a second look at the Miranda decision with an eye to possibly overruling it? The answer is that the whole question of how to protect suspects from police coercion has always been a difficult one for the court. For most of the 20th century, the rule was that if viewed in the totality of the circumstances a statement was voluntarily given, it could be used in evidence against a suspect. Eventually, though, the court reluctantly concluded that rule was simply not working to prevent police abuse. And in 1966, in the Miranda case, the court said that a suspect had to be told what his rights were, and he had to knowingly waive those rights in order for his own statement to be allowed as evidence against him at trial. The court laid down a specific set of warnings as an example of what was needed, though it acknowledged that Congress was free to substitute some other equally good remedy. With police and prosecutors in full-throated battle cry against Miranda, Congress did, in fact, soon step in with a quick fix. But the fix, in the form of a new federal law, did little more than to codify and reinstate the old voluntariness standard, and there was such great doubt about the constitutionality of what Congress had done that the new law was never systematically enforced. And the law, known as Section 3501 for its designated section in the criminal code, was largely ignored. So much so that the manual for federal prosecutors for decades has made mention only of the requirements of Miranda and no mention of 3501. The dog that didn't bark did not go entirely unnoticed, however. In the early 1990s, Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia asked about it in oral arguments, pressing Justice Department prosecutors about why they had never tried to enforce the law overruling Miranda.
I find it extraordinary that you don't take a position on that and haven't taken a position on that for many years. I can't understand. The language of 3501 seems to squarely apply, and the government just comes in time after time, doesn't take any position on raising 3501, continues to argue Miranda as though there's no statute explicitly addressing it.
Enter Paul Cassell, a conservative University of Utah law professor who's made something of a career of trying to activate the long-dormant 3501. In 1998, he saw an opportunity in the case of Charles Dickerson, a man charged with participating in a Virginia bank robbery. In the course of being questioned by federal agents, Dickerson had made some incriminating statements. But a federal trial judge ruled that because Dickerson had made those statements before being advised of his rights, they could not be used at trial against him. Cassell saw the case as a perfect vehicle for the argument that even if the defendant was not advised of his rights, his statements were still voluntary and admissible under 3501. And when the Justice Department refused to pursue that line of argument on appeal, Cassell did. Unexpectedly, the conservative Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals allowed him into the case and handed him a victory. Dickerson then appealed to the U.S. Supreme Court, which promptly asked the Justice Department for its views, and in a rare move, the department, which usually routinely defends any law enacted by Congress, this time took the opposite view. In a brief signed by Attorney General Janet Reno, the department urged the High Court to resolve the issue once and for all and said that, in its view, the court should strike down 3501 as unconstitutional. So now the fat is in the fire, and today's argument will provide the sizzle. At the heart of the argument is whether the 1966 Miranda decision actually established a constitutional rule of law, or whether it was based on something less. If it was based on the Constitution, it cannot be overruled by statute. Only a constitutional amendment would do the trick. But if, as Professor Cassell argues, the Miranda decision was based on something less, well, then Congress is free to change the law.
Miranda was sort of a placeholder. Because Congress had not acted, the court stepped in to create some rules. But then in 1968, Congress did act and create new rules that substitute the Miranda rules.
Defenders of the Miranda rule acknowledge that the Supreme Court in 1966 left the legislature free to experiment, but they say the court imposed some minimum requirements. James Hundley represents the defendant in this case, Charles Dickerson.
Yes, other procedures besides the warnings themselves are available. However, they must be as effective as the warnings in apprising an individual of his or her rights and giving him an opportunity to exercise those rights. And clearly the statute in question here doesn't satisfy that constitutional minimum.
Remember, he argues, the Supreme Court in Miranda found that police interrogations are inherently coercive and thus have been shown to produce unreliable or even false confessions.
You're taken out of your home, you're handcuffed, you're driven to the police station, you're put in a locked interrogation room, and you're surrounded by police officers who have basically one goal in mind, to get you to confess.
But Professor Cassell argues times have changed since 1966 and that it makes no sense in the year 2000 to exclude confessions that are given without a Miranda warning.
Back in 1966, maybe it made sense to assume that a suspect did not know about the right to remain silent. But today, schoolchildren are able to recite the Miranda warnings, and so we really live in a vastly different society.
To continue to adhere to the specifics of Miranda, he argues, is to eliminate valuable and incriminating evidence.
And that's what's at issue with this case, whether guilty criminals will go free because police officers have made a mistake in administering the technical Miranda rules.
Cassell predicts that in most cases anyway, police would continue to give Miranda warnings, and he points to the Justice Department's assertion that its agents would continue to do so regardless of how the court rules. But defense lawyer Hundley counters that it's never the easy cases that are the problem.
Police officers will continue to give warnings until they are confronted in an interrogation by an individual they feel will not confess if they give them the warnings, and then they won't give the warnings.
And he says then you're back at square one with the very problems that spawned the original Miranda ruling. In the Supreme Court today, the Clinton administration will tell the justices that, in fact, the best way to guarantee an efficient criminal justice system is with the bright lines established 34 years ago in Miranda. Perhaps more importantly, though, the administration will argue that to overrule Miranda now would undermine public confidence in a stable criminal justice system. Robert Litt served as Associate Deputy Attorney General in the Clinton administration.
For 32 years, the Miranda decision has been the guiding principle by which admission of confessions has been governed in this country. More than that, it stood as a symbol of our country's commitment to the rule of law, to the judicial control of police behavior, and to individual dignity and self-determination. Now, at a time when crime rates are falling all over the country, but when mistrust of the police is increasing, we're being asked to cast this rule aside. I don't think we should do so. I don't think we have to do so. And I don't think that Congress had the power to do so in Section 3501.
Professor Cassell counters that the Supreme Court's reconsideration of Miranda today is and should be the leading edge of a new movement at the High Court to undo much of the jurisprudence of the last century on the criminal law, a jurisprudence that punished all police misconduct the same way by disallowing evidence obtained improperly.
I see this as part of a broader movement that suggests that we're going to emphasize truth in our courtroom, that one of the paramount values is giving the jury all reliable evidence so that they can make an accurate determination about the guilt or innocence of an accused defendant.
A decision in the case is expected by summer. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.